from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's been more than a week now, and everybody's had time to think about it, turn it around in their heads, expel it again, and still, there's an eerie silence on the political landscape, at least. Now, because this program has, in the welter of talk about, quote, liberal talk radio, this program has been mentioned as a, quote, liberal talk radio program, and that's two unquotes now I owe you, maybe it's time to say the Kerry campaign has collected $56 million, and he's spent an hour on Meet the Press, and he's been fundraising in Louisiana. Now, first of all, with all due respect to my adopted home state, if you're fundraising in Louisiana, basically you are bottom fishing. You really could be spending your time more profitably than that. There was something else going on. I think it was an environmental photo op, because fundraising in Louisiana, you know, just put the penny jar out there, ladies and gentlemen, is what I'm saying. Anyway, what we didn't hear from John Kerry this week, what one might have expected to hear, is this. CIA Director George Tenet tells the 9/11 Commission that when the August 6th presidential daily briefing was issued that said Osama bin Laden plans to strike U.S. from inside U.S., and George Tenet was asked, did you brief the president on that briefing? Because apparently the president doesn't read his briefings. He has Tenet read them or summarize them to him. It's an important job, ladies and gentlemen. Tenet's answer was, no, I didn't brief him on that putatively important briefing. And the follow-up question, because there was a follow-up question, was, why not? And Tenet, well, the president was in Crawford, Texas, and I was on leave, i.e. on vacation. Did you brief him when Zacharias Massari was arrested later in August that year? The guy who was learning to fly a plane without learning to take off or land. No, I didn't. I was still on the thing, and he was still in Crawford, Texas. And this is the same George Tenet who, according to the Robert Woodward book, when the president expresses disbelief at the weakness of the case that Iraq has WMDs, George W.M.D. Bush, the president, George Tenet replies, no, it's a slam dunk case. So that's two big ones, three big ones, maybe. He doesn't brief the president on August 6th, doesn't brief the president when Massawi's arrested, tells the president it's a slam dunk. Those would be three, you know, you wouldn't want those on your permanent record, ladies and gentlemen. Let's be honest. So yet we didn't hear John Kerry say, why is George Tenet still on the public payroll? And what does he know that keeps him from being fired? We haven't heard that, but hello, welcome to the show.
Mazda don't do what it please, but it can't hide his deed. Some of y'all refuse to believe, but the fruit don't fall far from the tree. Mazda Tom always get what he need. Every time I see Miss Sally, Mazda Tom tell us with the scene. Keep his own love in slavery. I got three boys and one girl. Massa Tom set them free in this world. Sally understand one son asked why. He the only one didn't pass for why. In the big house on the hill, no cold wind blow, no winter chill. To the house, better get to the field.
from a lie.
Thank you.
From the other edge of America, the Gulf Coast, from the French Quarter in New Orleans, Louisiana, where it's warming up nicely, thank you. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to the still, yet and still, another edition of Le Show. And just to give you an idea of what we're dealing with down here, when a John Kerry comes to campaign, when I said bottom fishing, here's the most talked about bill in the Louisiana state legislature this year. Hog-dog rodeos. A bill to outlaw hog-dog rodeos. Now, these are not dogs dressed up like hogs, or dogs that think they're hogs, or hogs that think they're dogs. These are events that let dogs tear into wild hogs within an enclosed area would be illegal if legislation approved by a House of Representatives panel this past week becomes law. Exempted from the proposed ban are Uncle Earl's hog dog trials and similar hog baying competitions that involve dogs herding or cornering hogs in a pen. Well, those are good. We like those. But any event staged with the intention of injuring, maiming, mutilating, or killing the animals would be outlawed by House Bill 1244. Even with the exemption, supporters of the Uncle Earl event, which is all of that's a tradition. It's 10 years old. Turned out in force to oppose the legislation, saying it's merely the first step in an effort to outlaw all competitions pitting hog against dog. This is Louisiana I'm talking about, ladies and gentlemen. I hate to see a lot of talking about maimed and mauled and killed. That don't happen, says Jimmy Young, a producer of Uncle Earl's Hog Dog Trials. The opponents of the bill were led by legendary former state senator B.B. 60 Rayburn. Doesn't say how he got his nickname. He said he went on his first hog hunting trip in 1948 with then-Governor Earl Long, whose name is now attached to the hog dog trials. I can't understand why people are all so upset about a hog's ear, said the 88-year-old Rayburn, responding to a video shown by bill proponents that depicted pit bulls pinning hogs, chewing on the boar's ears and snouts. The dogs often had to be pried off by a handler. Authorities in East Feliciana Parish are allowing this kind of rodeo. The bill was passed 8-3 by the Criminal Justice Committee. Competitions like Uncle Earl's Hog Dog Trials feature hounds often equipped with protective vests to guard against the boar's tusks, cornering the hogs in a pen. If the dog attacks the hog, points are deducted from the score. Well, you know the dogs care about those points. The hogs in the hog dog rodeo, ladies and gentlemen. This is just a note, a cultural note. The hogs in the hog dog rodeo have their tusks removed. And speaking of legislation, Dateline Las Vegas, much like Louisiana, except gaudier and fewer hogs. Except for this guy. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the headline of this would be Powell Gets Tough. And of course, the punchline would be, it's the sun. The head of the U.S. Federal Communications Commission warned television broadcasters this week they could face a backlash if they resist plans to complete the transition to digital television by, note the new date now, 2009. We told you for years, 2005, the original date was a dream, a digital dream. Now here's the new date, 2009, and the television broadcasters are saying, well, that's a dream. But FCC Chairman Michael Powell, the tough Powell, urged broadcasters to reconsider their opposition. He said the opposition could backfire if Congress wants the spectrum. See, right now they have analog and digital spectrum. Congress wants the analog spectrum back so it can auction it off and make some money. I don't think you have 50 more years of government willingness to allow the spectrum to be used just for this purpose, Powell warned the broadcasters. The FCC is weighing a plan to require stations to only broadcast digital signals by 2009 and count those homes that get their broadcast channels from cable and satellite towards the 85% threshold that will trigger the analog shutoff, even though, to make this plan work, cable and satellite companies would convert the new digital signals back to analog for all of their customers. That would be the digital switchover, ladies and gentlemen, where it would get broadcast in digital and then down-converted, I believe is the term of art, to analog for you cable and satellite users. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I am a cable user. My cable system already down-converts its digital feed to analog. Don't be fooled. It doesn't look as good as analog. That's the deal we're making. To get these pristine digital pictures, you're going to end up with something that looks worse than what you've got today. That, ladies and gentlemen, is the digital wonderland. Now, let's follow up on Bob Woodward's book. Everybody knows that it made a lot of news this past week. A couple of items of interest in following up. First of all, you know that Colin Powell, the dad, the not-tough Powell, was quoted as warning George W. M.D. Bush, that in the advance, in the run-up to the Iraq War, that, you know, if the United States invaded, if we broke it, we own it. We own 25 million people. Powell called it the Pottery Barn Rule. This week, a corporate spokeswoman for Pottery Barn, Lee Oshirak, contradicted the Secretary of State. This is certainly not our policy in any of our 174 Pottery Barn retail outlets in North America. In fact, there is no policy regarding this whatsoever. A good percentage, she continued, of Pottery Barn's inventory is beds, but we do sell ceramics, glassware, kitchenware, and other things that are breakable. But if something breaks, that's the cost of doing business. We always put our customers first. That's part of our corporate values. If someone breaks a wine glass, our managers just mark it down as out of stock. The customer isn't asked to pay for it. Asked if the Pottery Barn Rule should apply to Iraq, Oshirak said, I'm not going to comment on the war or the people of Iraq. State Department spokesman tried to distance Powell from the so-called Pottery Barn Rule. Said the spokesperson, I don't think anybody from the State Department would ever have intended to cast aspersions on Pottery Barn's commitment to customer service. We've solved that. And the Pentagon deleted from a public transcript a statement that Donald Rumsfeld made to Bob Woodward suggesting that the administration gave Saudi Arabia a two-month heads-up on the start of the war. Rumsfeld told Prince Bandar bin Sultan, the Saudi ambassador, in 2003 January that he could take that to the bank that the invasion would happen. That's in Woodward's book. Rumsfeld and other officials were briefing Bandar on a military plan to attack and invade Iraq, and pointing to a top-secret map that showed how the war plan would unfold. This is in Woodward's book. Pentagon officials omitted this meeting from the transcript of the Woodward interview with Rumsfeld that they posted on the Defense Department's website. Rumsfeld told reporters at a briefing that he may have used the phrase, take that to the bank, but that didn't mean that a final decision had been made to go to war. It's a different kind of bank. It's a bank that you don't get money from. To my knowledge, says Rumsfeld, a decision had not been taken by the president to go to war at that meeting. There was certainly nothing I said that should have suggested that, and any suggestion to the contrary would not be accurate. Woodward supplied his own transcript showing that Rumsfeld told him in October of last year, I remember meeting with the vice president, and I think Dick Myers and I met with a foreign dignitary at one point, looked him in the eye and said, you can count on this. In other words, at some point we had enough of a signal from the president, we were able to look a foreign dignitary in the eye and said, you can take that to the bank, this is going to happen. The transcript made it clear the foreign dignitary was Prince Bandar, although Rumsfeld would not say that. Oh. So anyway, that's following up on Bob Woodward's book, ladies and gentlemen. You can take that to the bank, but the bank won't cash it because the bank's closed because it's not a bank. Arabs in the Middle East hate the United States more than ever following the invasion of Iraq. So says the president of Egypt, who just left the United States. He didn't say it while he was here. Now that's a bad guest. You're going to say we're hated. Say it to our face, Hosni. Today there was hatred of the Americans like never before in the region, he said. In France. He blamed the hostility partly on U.S. support for Israel. What about the freedom deficit? I thought that was the root cause. Isn't that what Condi said? That's the root cause of terrorism and everything bad. Quote, quoting Hosni Mubarak one more time. At the start, some considered the Americans were helping them. There was no hatred of the Americans. After what has happened in Iraq, there is unprecedented hatred, and the Americans know it. I think he means the American government. I don't think he means we Americans, you and me. I'm looking at you, know it. Hey, we're turning over sovereignty to the Iraqis June 30th. But it's limited sovereignty, ladies and gentlemen. It's like the Pottery Barn rule. It's limited furniture. The new Iraqi interim government will have only limited sovereignty over the country. That's according to Paul Wolfowitz and Undersecretary of State Mark Grossman. The new Iraqi government will have no authority over U.S. and coalition military forces already in country. The turnover was described in the past as granting total sovereignty to the appointed Iraqi government. Grossman termed it limited sovereignty because it is limited by the transitional law, I guess we wrote that, and the U.N. resolution. Under the current plan, U.N. Secretary General's Special Advisor Lakhdar Brahimi will appoint a temporary government that will run Iraqi government agencies for 6 months and prepare the way for those elections that are going to happen right about the time the digital TV transition is. Wolfowitz described the July 1st government as purely temporary, whose purpose is to run ministries, but most importantly, they'll be setting up elections. In addition, he said the government will run the police force, but in coordination with us, because this is not a normal police situation. So we transfer sovereignty, but the military decisions continue to reside indefinitely in the control of the American commander. Is that correct? asked Senator John Warner. That's correct, said the chief of staff. Sovereignty is not something we can or want to take back, Wolfowitz says. So we're not going to give it all the way through. Limited sovereignty, ladies and gentlemen. That may be a new concept in international law. We may be blazing new trails. Who knows? Meantime, what about our friend? You know that Honduras has joined Spain and the Dominican Republic most recently as withdrawing their troops from the Iraq, the coalition of the wilting. But now, what about our good friend Pakistan? A couple months ago, they had that high-value target cornered in tribal territory, and they had an all, you know, really tough siege going on to find that high-value target and to find the it's all over. Ladies and gentlemen, that's all over. Pakistani army says it has agreed to stop operations against tribesmen accused of sheltering al-Qaeda suspects near the Afghan border. If you shelter a terrorist, it's okay with me. Both sides in the South Waziristan area have pledged to resolve all outstanding issues in peace. Hey, somebody talked to some terrorists. Somebody negotiated with some terrorists, sounds like. The agreement was reached through the mediation of two parliamentarians. The move brings an end to fighting in South Waziristan. Thank goodness. The army says more than 100 militants and troops were killed last month. The BBC's Paul Anderson in Islamabad says the Americans have been depending on heavy military tactics from Pakistan in the area. American forces have been conducting their own operations on the Afghan side of the border in what they described as the coordinated hammer and anvil operation. You heard that? Well, guess who just moved the anvil? Ooh, wait, the hammer hit my hand. It was holding the anvil until they moved. Ow! Peshawar Corps Commander Safdar Hussain, there's that name again, and parliamentarian Mulana Mirajuddin both confirmed a broad understanding had been reached to end the fighting in South Waziristan. The formal announcement of the settlement will happen in a meeting which will include five villagers named as the most wanted Pakistani tribesmen. The Pakistani government will compensate tribesmen who suffered losses in the recent military operations or whose homes were demolished. Most of the 163 Pakistani tribesmen who were arrested during the military crackdown will be released. Unlike Guantanamo detainees, who may have had nothing to do with anything. These are the most wanted guys. These were the most wanted guys in this area of Pakistan. But it's Pakistan, ladies and gentlemen. It's not Chinatown. It's Pakistan. The deal was welcomed by a tribal parliamentarian named Mehrajuddin. He supports the anti-American six-party opposition religious alliance in the Pakistani parliament. The non-Pakistanis found in South Waziristan, oh, who would they be, will be allowed to live peacefully as refugees and guarantee not to use Pakistan's soil against any other country. That would be the only condition they have to make. I don't know if they have to sign that. The tribal elders in South Waziristan have simultaneously announced a suspension of their hunt for Al-Qaeda militants and their supporters. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, they sound like they're on the same kind of war footing. Just in case you've forgotten, Condi Rice said before 9/11, we were at battle stations. George W. M. D. Bush said we were not on a war footing. I guess he was right. I guess, in terms of Pakistan, he's still right. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Oh, an election here or there. The nation's second largest provider of voting systems has conceded that its flagship products in California have significant security flaws and that it's applied hundreds of poorly designed electronic voting devices the disenfranchised voters in the March presidential primary. Diebold Election Systems President Bob Urosevich admitted this and more and apologized for any embarrassment. We're not embarrassed, Bob. What about you? We were caught. This is a quote. We were caught. We apologize for that, he said of the mass failures of devices needed to call up digital ballots. Hey, just convert them to analog. We're sorry for the inconvenience of the voters, too. Unknown thousands were turned away at the polls March 2nd. Weren't they actually disenfranchised, asked the chief counsel to the state's elections division. After a moment, Urosevich agreed. Yes, sir. Leslie Stahl is not proud of the two pre-Iraq war reports she made, casting doubt on Saddam Hussein's claim to have rid Iraq of its weapons of mass destruction. I look on those two stories as mistakes, journalistic mistakes, Stahl told a crowd of about 1,000 gathered at Virginia Beach. I made them, and I regret it. She described a trip to Iraq in 2001, October, where she interviewed Iraqi officials, military leaders, and scientists. They told her Saddam had no ties to Osama bin Laden, that their secular Muslim country was just as much his enemy as the United States, and they told her that the country had gotten rid of its weapons of mass destruction. Stahl didn't buy the Iraqis' claims. Her instinct, she said, told her they were lying. I didn't believe anything the Iraqis were telling me about weapons of mass destruction, she said. Nobody believed their denials. Actor Kevin Spacey apologized for confusion arising from his report to police he'd been mugged in London. The Oscar-winning actor made, then retracted the complaint after a weekend encounter on a London park that left him dazed and bleeding. The Daily Mirror newspaper reported Spacey had been brutally mugged in a South London park at 4:30 a.m. last Saturday. Spacey told BBC Radio the truth was less dramatic. He said he was walking his dog when a young man approached him with some sob story about somebody needing to call their mother and could they use my phone. It was such a good con that I actually dialed the number myself, and when somebody answered, I then finally handed over my phone, said Spacey. And this kid took off, and I was so upset I ran after him. Spacey said he reported the incident to police, but went back a few hours later to clarify his story. He said he woke up after a couple of hours' sleep, and I thought, you know, there's a difference between assault and theft, and it just wasn't right for me not to come clean about my own level of embarrassment and being humble at the fact that I got taken by the oldest con going. Can I borrow your cell phone, con? That's the oldest con going? He said he actually injured himself when he tripped over his dog as he chased after the youth. Asked why he was walking his dog at 4:30 in the morning, Spacey replied, "My doggie had to go." Also in London, London Olympic chief Barbara Cassani, she's head of London's attempt to get the 2012 Olympics, accepted a public apology from the conservative London newspaper The Telegraph, which had published an article alleging that she claimed Prime Minister Blair wasn't very bright. The Telegraph will donate a total of $50,000 to the British Olympic Association and the British Paralympic Association. This newspaper said Barbara Cassani did not make any of the derogatory remarks about the Prime Minister which were attributed to her. George Bush, the Department of Homeland Security has apologized to British writer Ian McEwan for delaying his entry into Seattle last month. He was kept out of the country for 36 hours and his passport was stamped refuse admittance after U.S. Customs inspectors in Vancouver determined he did not have a proper visa to travel and to two other cities to deliver paid lectures. The letter of apology received last week by McEwen's immigration lawyer in Portland, Oregon, said the customs officials have concluded your refusal was processed in error. Please accept my apologies for any inconvenience and delay the refusal process caused you, wrote William S. Heffelfinger III. Yes, there's a grand old Heffelfinger family in the Bureau of Customs. He attempted to come into the country, McEwan did, under a visa waiver normally granted to British citizens, but aroused suspicion when he said he would be paid $15,000 for his three lectures. The letter of apology said border inspectors failed to follow immigration rules which allow foreigners to accept lecture honorariums with no dollar limit. And finally, ladies and gentlemen, the University of Alabama apologized this week to the descendants of slaves who were owned by faculty members or who worked on campus in the years before the Civil War. The apology, approved overwhelmingly by the Faculty Senate, was the first of the university, and possibly the first of its kind in the nation, according to university officials. The school will erect a marker near the graves of two slaves on the campus and place others in the buildings where slaves worked. The president of the Faculty Senate, John Mason, called the apology very important symbolism at the school, scene of Governor George Wallace's stand in the schoolhouse door against integration in 1963. Said Mason of the apology, "I think this sends a message to people of color that you're welcome here." A black senior at the school, Robert Turner, said the apology would make the university more inviting. "I think it shows the university does not shy away from its history." The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. If you had a show, wouldn't it be a copyrighted feature of your show?
That's just the way it is. But all I need is one friend to get me through the day. One friend who never goes away. Only one friend to understand and never let me down. Well, I've been in love and I've been in pain. I'm a sinner and a saint. And no matter where I am or what I do, it's you I appreciate. My one friend to get me through the day. One friend who never goes away. Understand and never let me down, and never let me down. Can't nobody love you more than you love yourself. And as long as I got my one good friend, I don't need nobody else. just my one friend, getting through the day. One friend never goes away. Only one friend to understand and never let me down. All I need is one friend to get me through the day. One friend never goes away. Only one friend to understand and never let me down. Never let me down.
It's time now for the Health File with Dr. Manfred Weitzner. In addition to being a New Age internist with a practice in Arcadia, Dr. Weitzner has a degree in forensic broadcasting from the University of Leipzig. Dr. Weitzner.
Thank you very much, Tim, and welcome, dear listeners, back within the capacious confines of the Health File. You know, friends, in the years that we've been emphasizing the mind-body connection, nothing has come to mind or body so frequently as the evidence that this really is the way we are all wired. And evidence is accumulating faster than unanswered emails in the digital bowels of the Health File. Just this week, the respected British medical journal The Clamp reported on a study indicating that people who liked what they saw on television had healthier immune systems compared to the grumpy gusses that watched more in sorrow than in pleasure. Will this someday lead to a world where you can sue the networks if you develop acute pleuropathy? I don't know, but maybe I should go back to law school.
You're listening to The Health File with Dr. Manfred Weitzner. Dr. Weitzner welcomes mail from listeners, but healthfile.com is currently being blocked by some internet spam filters. Once again, Dr. Weitzner.
Thanks, Tim, and we do want to take just the merest moment to say that Tim's book, Announcing for Dummies, is currently available in paper bags. Sorry, that should be in paperback. In the sensory messages we get once we leave the Manila sanctum of the Health File, nothing is more ubiquitous than the television commercials for what the computer savvy might describe as Viagra 2.0. From propounding a cure for what we used to call a flaccid penis, the pharmaceutical industry has now migrated to selling length of time as well as the other kind. We've all heard mention of the peculiar side effect, erections lasting more than 4 hours, requiring an immediate menstruation from the doc. But a physician in nearby Tarzana says this may be a more serious problem than it sounds. Dr. Tracy Banerjee runs the Erectile Emergency Center at Tarzana St. Luke's Metaplex. Dr. Banerjee, welcome within the multicolored dividers of the Health File.
Thank you.
You've stumbled across a whole new syndrome, haven't you?
We call it APAS, Dr. Weitzner.
APAS, A-P-P-A-S, that would be... What would that be?
Acute prolonged painful arousal syndrome. That's mm-hmm. the state that these medications are inducing.
You've seen a lot of four-hour episodes, Dr. Banerjee?
Dr. Weitzner, in all seriousness, have you ever seen a waiting room completely filled with male patients experiencing severe, unrelieved tumescence?
Back when I was in the Peace Corps, I did see something like that in Mozambique, but it did have a completely different etiology.
If I remembered my college medical anthropology, they would have also been profoundly scarred.
You recall it correctly. Dr. Banerjee, what's prescribed for the, and you'll pardon me, the growing number mm-hmm. of patients who appear to be presenting with an excess of presenting? More fresh fruits and vegetables, another powerful pharmaceutical, or just megadoses of vitamin L for love?
Well, my point, Dr. Weitzner, and I will answer that question. My point is simply that no physician I knew had ever been confronted with this situation before. I really had to embark on a trial and error process to come up with a therapeutic regimen that isn't drug dependent, because a lot of these patients really have shut their paychecks on the medication that put them in this situation in the first place. Now, on a physical level, the goal is to reduce blood flow to the affected area. On a psychic level, of course, to reduce feelings of arousal.
Which, given the mind-body connection, will itself contribute to hypohemia.
So in combination with a low dose of aspirin...
For its blood-thinning effect?
That's correct. There's a precisely timed exposure to anti-arousal imagery.
Oh, and these would be?
Well, the most efficacious materials are proprietary. Mm. But some more common examples would be still panoramic images of a barren desert, a program of severely out-of-date agricultural news features, and black-and-white footage of mature women playing field hockey.
And the need for precisely timed exposure would be, aside from the obvious...
What would be the obvious?
Just the desire in the scientific realm to provide for repeatability of results.
Well, that obvious, yes. Mm-hmm. But the reason in this regimen is that a prolonged exposure to even the strongest anti-arousal material will have a contrary effect in a certain percentage of the patient population.
Mm. These would be what in an earlier day would have been referred to as weirdos.
That's correct.
Dr. Banerjee, can we expect to see more erectile emergency centers as the advertising wars heat up for these powerful party extenders?
Well, that's entirely up to our investors. We're ready to roll it out as soon as the funds clear because, believe me, Dr. Weitzner, the smiles on the faces of these patients post-treatment is worth more than money.
Not that much more.
Maybe not.
As the ads say, if the moment is right, you might not be ready, but at least you will be sparing yourself a trouser-popping visit to the doc. Dr. Tracy Banerjee, as usual, our thanks for a first visit to the orderly vicinity of the Health File. I hope it's not your last.
I'm sure I hope so, too.
And so, dear friends, I thank you for listening. I wish you mega doses of vitamin C. See you next week. And now, so long from within the fast-closing panels of the Health File. So long.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for me to read the trades for you. Would you like that? Fortunately, this is not an interactive broadcast. This is a double-barreled trades reading for your listening pleasure. And yet there are no barrels. How does that happen? First, from the New York Times advertising column, new survey on ad effectiveness. I'll read it for you. At the 2004 Management Conference of the American Association of Advertising Agencies, senior executives learned the results of a survey of consumers conducted on behalf of the organization by Yankelovich Partners. The survey shows that the effectiveness of ad campaigns is deteriorating, says J. Walker Smith, president of Yankelovich. That's because negative perceptions about advertising have substantially increased. That's good work, guys. These survey findings are significant because industry executives are frantically searching for ways to forge more emotional connections with consumers, described in this column as fractious and fractionated. Poor consumers. Ways to forge more emotional connections that differ from conventional methods like running TV and print ads. The risk posed by some of the new approaches, like placing sponsored brand messages or products in the entertainment content of programs or publications, is that consumers will consider such strategies even more obnoxious, says Mr. Smith of Yankelovich. People have a love-hate relationship with advertising. Well, he's half right. But a far greater percentage, he continues, say they have concerns, primarily related to its growing obtrusiveness. 54% of the survey respondents say they avoid buying products that overwhelm them with advertising and marketing. 60% said their opinion of advertising is much more negative than just a few years ago. 61% said they agreed that the amount of advertising and marketing to which they are exposed is, quote, out of control, unquote. 69% said they are interested in products and services that would help them skip or block marketing. Even when fewer than a majority of the respondents agreed with the statement, Smith said, the results offered little solace for ad agencies. For example, what he called a fairly significant 45% of respondents said the amount of advertising and marketing they were exposed to detracts from the experience of everyday life. 33% said they would be willing to have a slightly lower standard of living to live in a society without advertising. The results offer some suggestions, too, Smith said, to help narrow what he describes as the growing gap between how consumers want to be communicated with and the way advertisers communicate. For example, respondents said there's an opportunity for advertising to become a source of competitive advantage if it's focused on product features and services. Now listen to Smith's next quote. The marketing itself has to become a part of how consumers view a brand. So if you have two brands at parity with each other, more and more the one people are likely to do business with is the one that does a better job in reaching them with its advertising, unquote. Not the one that does a better job of explaining product features and services, which is what the... Did he read his own survey, ladies and gentlemen, you might ask? But now, onward, advertising age, marketers press for product placement in magazine text. Did they read the survey? Dateline New York, commercial messages have seeped into the plots of movies, the very fabric of TV shows and video games, and even into the plots of novels. But that may have just been the beachhead. Now a growing number of marketers want to persuade the nation's magazines to open the text of their editorial pages to product placement. Says Matthew Spahn, director of media planning at Sears, the only way we're going to be more successful is to get even more creative and try to find ways to address this church and state issue of editorial versus advertising. I guess advertising would be the state or the church. Mr. Spahn spoke of media partners working in much less traditional ways that go way beyond just buying ad pages. It's more about integration of the product, becoming part of the storyline in ways that readers or viewers will still be interested in consuming that material. He admitted he's not fully sure what the magazine equivalent of Sears' deal with ABC's Extreme Makeover might look like, but expressed dissatisfaction with magazines' attempts to play in this space. They still think in terms of advertorials, he said, which doesn't feel like part of the fabric of editorial. It's a huge challenge for magazines, Mr. Spahn conceded, but they've got to figure this out. We're getting a little frustrated, frankly, trying to get them there. Magazine executives testified to increased pressure from advertisers to break down or breach traditional walls. Says Nina Lawrence, publisher of Modern Bride, more advertisers ask us to blur the lines between advertising and editorial. It's accelerated in the last year. She placed the blame for this squarely on branded entertainment deals. Advertisers are asking for what they want on TV, and they're getting it. Any sort of product placement deals in magazines would blatantly violate the industry's accepted rules. According to the American Society of Magazine Editor Guidelines, ad messages and ad pages should be, quote, distinctly different from the publication's normal layout. In truth, consumer magazines' dance with their advertisers is universally conceded not to be a wholly chaste affair. Key beauty and fashion advertisers, for instance, are often depicted in product layouts among magazines dependent upon them as part of open secret horse trading of editorial credits for advertising. Says Soroush Alvi, a co-founder of the lifestyle magazine Vice, we usually use our fashion sections as the place to throw some of our clients a bone. Here, boy. A new generation of marketers is excited by the prospect of embedding messages in American Idol, Tomb Raider 2, or even novels. More broadly, the commercialization of the American landscape now encompasses the sponsorships of stadiums, arenas, even public spaces such as museums and national parks. How do you maintain integrity in a world where the lines are blurring, wondered one veteran branding executive. In magazines, the dividing line does vary from one to another, sometimes shockingly so. Dave Itzkoff, a former editor of Maxim, said that during production, editorial pages were reviewed by someone in the ad department who would scan for mentions of any brand name product. If advertisers' product were mentioned in any disparaging way, the ad staffer would approach to say, please delete it, or make the reference more generic. And if we mentioned a product in a favorable light that was not an advertiser, the ad side would request to find a competing product who is an advertiser and change the reference to that. The bigger question, of course, is if any attempts to get branded entertainment into magazines will be met with consumer acceptance, a la American Idol and AT&T Wireless, or consumer backlash. Executives point out that a new generation of consumers has grown up receiving marketing message embedded in entertainment products. And they also point to the broad acceptance of shopping magazines such as Lucky, which indicates consumers tolerate openly commerce-oriented titles. Ultimately, your ability to create revenue for the advertiser will get hurt if you're jeopardizing the loyalty of the reader, says Brad Ball, who heads Ball Entertainment Group. Still, he suggested in the future you might find an entire subject in a well-known magazine brought to you by a key advertiser. Within a 5-year window, he said, the rule books of marketing will be rewritten. Last month, a Major League Baseball vice president said never say never to the possibility of paid-for logos appearing on baseball uniforms in the United States. Maybe they should have stuck with 3 minutes of commercials in each half-hour TV show. What do you think? Oh, just a speculation brought to mind when I read the trades for you. A copyrighted feature in this broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, last week I threw down the gauntlet. I issued the challenge. Can you find the world's most expensive banana? Some early reports in from James at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. The restaurant Rivers charges $1.81 plus tax, total of $2 for a banana. Brian reports $1.50 at Disneyland, and it had green spots. I think he means the banana. Rory says, just had breakfast at Art's Deli in Studio City in Los Angeles. The banana was $1.95 plus tip, total $2.30. And a report from Zurich Airport, a banana at the current exchange rate was walked out the door for $1.54. Okay, we know the range now. The possibilities are growing for the world's most expensive banana. Ladies and gentlemen, your submission, that is to say your entry, Your submission is always welcome, but so is your entry. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet 7.415 megahertz. On your computer, around the world, via the internet, whenever you want it, live and archived at two different locations, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, and now available as a free download at audible.com/LeShow. And it would be just like us being at battle stations and on a war footing if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. Oh, you know what? Time for just one more cute thing. Dateline Jakarta, Indonesia. The United States can work with former military chief Wiranto if he wins the Indonesian presidency, despite his indictment for crimes against humanity. That's according to U.S. Ambassador Ralph Boyce. Boyce told reporters, "We can work with anybody that comes out of a free election process. I guess, except for Aristide." He didn't say that. "We're not involved in selecting individual candidates, supporting or opposing individual candidates. It's the election process that we care about deeply, and it seems to be going very well." The email address for this broadcast is lemail. I'm laughing at something else, of course. Lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack. Le Show playlists usually available at the newly refurbished harryshearer.com, where the database is now searchable, whatever the hell that means. And our thanks, as usual, when we're in New Orleans, for the ineffable services of Mr. Bob Dunn, without whom it need not be said. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. From the French Quarter in New Orleans, so long.